The full story's on voanews.com. Via remote, I'm Liz Pelka, VOA News.
Today is Wednesday, July 8th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. New COVID-19 evidence could change how governments respond to the pandemic.
We believe that we have to be open to this evidence and understand its implications.
The information comes as more countries are reintroducing lockdowns. Plus, Beijing opens up its new security office in Hong Kong.
The unveiling of the office was marked with a closed ceremony.
We'll have those stories and more next. The World Health Organization is studying emerging evidence that the novel coronavirus may be spread through the air more easily than previously believed. And the United States National Institute of Health's Dr. Anthony Fauci says it would follow the example from an earlier deadly disease, SARS. Reuters' Matthew LaRotonda starts us off.
The World Health Organization is now saying that coronavirus may be spread through the air more easily than previously believed, lingering longer and moving for further distances between people in an aerosol form. After hundreds of scientists pled with the agency to consider the evidence in an open letter over the weekend. If it's true, it could change how governments have been fighting the virus, including the 1 and 2 meter separation rule many countries adopted for social distancing. This was the WHO's technical lead for controlling the pandemic, Benedetta Alegranzi, in a news conference on Tuesday.
We acknowledge that there is emerging evidence in this field, as in all other fields, regarding the COVID-19 virus and pandemic. And therefore, we believe that we have to be open to this evidence and understand its implications regarding the modes of transmission and also regarding the precautions that need to be taken.
The WHO was quick to say that the evidence is not final and they're expected to put out their most recent findings in coming days. Dr. Anthony Fauci of the White House's pandemic response had this to say.
There isn't a lot of definitive evidence about what the impact of the aerosolization is on COVID expression. However, we have some good examples back with SARS, which is a similar virus, where there were clear-cut examples of spread by aerosol. So although we don't think it's a major issue of spread, it's something that we can't completely rule out.
Fauci says this is one of the reasons why people need to wear masks to protect themselves and others.
That was Reuters reporter Matthew LaRotonda. Across the globe, nations are facing new lockdowns as the coronavirus flares up again. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma takes things from here.
Australia has isolated the state of Victoria in a bid to contain the worsening spread of the virus as the city of Melbourne prepares for its second lockdown, an example of a resurgent disease in places that initially succeeded in taming it. While in Serbia, chaos erupted as thousands of protesters battled police and tried to storm the Belgrade Parliament building after the president announced a lockdown will be reintroduced. China, however, hopes a latest spike has now died down. Only 7 new cases have been confirmed, all of them brought from outside the country. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
A Johns Hopkins University tracker puts the total number of confirmed COVID-19 cases at just under 11.9 million, with the United States having nearly 3 million cases alone. China opened its new national security office in Hong Kong Wednesday, turning a hotel near the city center park that has been a popular venue for pro-democracy protests into its new headquarters. Reuters' Libby Hogan has that story.
As the red Chinese emblem was fixed above the door, what was only recently a hotel on Hong Kong's waterfront welcoming tourists became the city's new national security office. On Wednesday, China revealed that they had converted Hong Kong's former Metro Park Hotel with its pool and prime views of Victoria Harbour into temporary headquarters for an office to enforce its new national security law for the city. Security was tight for the office's opening on Wednesday. Hong Kongers that Reuters spoke to expressed surprise at how quickly it opened.
There's been no notice of the new office. They didn't notify the public and then blocked the road. All of a sudden, there's so much going on. I suddenly see on the news that a flag is raised, the road is closed, and so many officials are out on the streets.
The law came into force just over a week ago. It punishes crimes of secession, subversion, terrorism, and collusion with foreign forces with up to life in prison. The law also empowers the new office to take enforcement action beyond existing Hong Kong laws in the most serious cases and take suspects into the mainland for trials in China's communist-controlled courts. The Metro Park Hotel sits near Victoria Park, a central city space popular for some of the biggest pro-democracy protests last year. The unveiling of the office was marked with a closed ceremony, with the newly appointed chief of the office, Zhang Yanzhong. Zhang rose to prominence during a crackdown on land rights protesters in the southern Chinese city of Wuhan in 2011. He has extensive experience in propaganda, and leaked footage of him during that time shows him berating villagers and calling foreign media rotten. Police have arrested at least 10 people, including a 15-year-old, under the new law for suspected threats to China's national security.
Libby Hogan reports for Reuters News. There are growing calls for Britain to also enact sanctions against human rights abusers in China after the first such measures were imposed against dozens of individuals from Russia and Saudi Arabia. The first so-called Magnitsky sanctions were announced on Monday following years of campaigning by friends and family of Sergei Magnitsky, a Russian lawyer killed in 2009. As Henry Ridgewell reports, activists hope the sanctions will have a substantial impact.
Sergei Magnitsky, a Russian lawyer investigating state corruption, died in a Moscow jail in 2009. His body showed signs of torture. No one has been convicted because of his death. In the decades since, his client, Bill Browder, has fought for governments around the world to enact sanctions against those involved in Magnitsky's demise. The campaign marked a milestone Monday as Britain announced its first targeted sanctions.
Those with blood on their hands, the thugs of despots, the henchmen of dictators, will not be free to waltz into this country to buy up property on the King's Road, to do their Christmas shopping in Knightsbridge, or frankly, to siphon dirty money through British banks or other financial institutions.
25 Russian officials allegedly involved in Magnitsky's death face asset freezes and travel bans, including directors of Russia's investigative committee, which reports directly to President Vladimir Putin, members of the General Prosecutor's Office, as well as judges. Russia has asked Interpol to arrest Bill Browder 7 times on charges of tax evasion. Browder says the charges are baseless and evidence of his campaign success.
Putin values money more than human life, and we've created a mechanism to take his money away from him, and that's just unforgivable as far as he's concerned.
Britain also enacted sanctions Monday against 20 Saudi Arabian nationals accused of the gruesome murder of the American journalist Jamal Khashoggi, who wrote for The Washington Post. Further measures target officials in Myanmar and North Korea. Some British lawmakers are calling for Hong Kong's chief executive, Carrie Lam, to be added to the sanctions list following China's imposition of a new security law, which critics say infringes upon basic human rights, including freedom of speech.
China is probably the prime example of a human rights abuser that should have people sanctioned. They should be stung for what they've done to the Uyghur population, for what they're doing in Hong Kong.
The United States and Canada already have Magnitsky-style legislation in place. The European Union is working on its own.
If the EU is not involved, then these people will buy villas in the south of France, they'll keep their money in German banks, and they'll send their kids to Swiss boarding schools. And so we need to get Europe on board.
Britain says it is determined to forge a new role as a global beacon for human rights. Analysts say the measures will test Britain's clout outside the EU. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
And still to come,
we have really high unemployment, typically close to 50% for the United States, with 12% with the Great Recession. People were jumping off of buildings.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
NASA's Curiosity Mars rover continues its mission as it slowly climbs and explores the 5-kilometer-high Mount Sharp. According to NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, the rover has spent more than a year in a region of the mountain that is rich with clay. Curiosity's controllers have recently set it on a 1.6-kilometer-long road trip around some deep sand so that it can continue its climb to the next section of the mountain that is said to be rich in sulfates. Sulfates are a chemical compound made up of one sulfur atom surrounded by 4 atoms of oxygen, and according to JPL, usually forms around water as it evaporates. It's thought that they'll provide clues on how climate and chances for life on Mars changed 3 billion years ago. NASA's new Mars rover, Perseverance, is set to be launched at the end of July. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The extradition case of Meng Wanzhou, the chief financial officer of the Chinese tech firm Huawei, is very slowly winding its way through the Canadian legal system. For Meng, it means confinement to her Vancouver mansion and conferences with high-priced lawyers. For two Canadians, it means more uncertainty and more time in a Chinese jail. Combine that with the U.S. presidential election and a rift in Canadian-Chinese trade relations, and the matter becomes even more complex. Craig McCulloch has that story.
If all goes according to schedule, the actual extradition hearing for Meng Wanzhou, the CFO of technology giant Huawei, will start on April 23, 2021. Before that, she faces multiple court dates in front of the Supreme Court of the Province of British Columbia and the Federal Court of Canada. The U.S. Justice Department is seeking her extradition from Vancouver on allegations of helping a Huawei subsidiary break U.S. sanctions against doing business in Iran. The daughter of Chinese technology giant Huawei founder Ren Zhengfei, Meng was arrested in Vancouver International Airport while in transition to her connecting flight to Mexico on December 1, 2018. That means the actual extradition hearing may take place more than 28 months after her arrest. Intensely watching the proceedings is Vancouver immigration lawyer and policy analyst Richard Kurland, who does not represent any party in the case. He says for a person like Meng, the case is not taking a long time.
It's not slow. This is the typical average garden variety vanilla extradition case processing times. I'm aware of at least 3 other extradition cases that required 8 to 10 years to finish.
Kurland adds that for those with less financial means than Meng, the extradition process can be rather abrupt.
Typically, in the overwhelming majority of cases, extradition from beginning to end is a matter of days, if not a short number of months.
Not long after Meng's arrest, two Canadian citizens, now commonly referred to as the two Mikes, Michael Spavor and Michael Kovrig, were detained in China. Spavor, who specialized in travel from the People's Republic of China and North Korea, and Kovrig, a former diplomat who works with a non-profit research organization, lived most of the time in China. They were initially accused of endangering Chinese security, but were not formally charged until June of this year. Spavor is facing charges of spying and transmitting secrets outside of China. Kovrig is facing charges of spying on Chinese state secrets for other countries. In the past, both men have been denied legal counsel or the ability to see family members and have only been granted infrequent visits by Canadian diplomatic staff in China. One former Canadian diplomat who used to visit Canadians in Chinese prisons is Colin Robertson, currently vice president of the Canadian Global Affairs Institute. One of his many diplomatic postings was in Hong Kong, from where he often traveled to China. He says conditions in such facilities are usually deplorable. While Meng is out on bail and lives in her choice of her two Vancouver mansions, the two Michaels are not so lucky. And Kovrig's former diplomatic career is also an issue.
But certainly in the case of Kovrig, the Chinese were questioning him about his activities as a Canadian diplomat day after day, hour after hour, which is in total violation of his privileges and privileges of diplomats, of which Chinese diplomats also enjoy under the Vienna Conventions, which date back to 1815.
Robertson says the relationship between Canada and China is at the lowest point since modern diplomatic relations were established under Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau, the father of current Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, over 50 years ago. He says that has led to a number of trade complaints.
And the Chinese continue to find things, more recently seafood and now looking at lumber, that are just basically trade harassment. And my own view is I think we needed a more muscular response earlier on.
A public opinion survey at the end of June by the Angus Reid Institute found that over 72% of Canadians backed Trudeau's refusal to stop the extradition hearing and send Meng back to China in exchange for the two Michaels. Trudeau said doing so would set a dangerous precedent and that he would let the Canadian justice system, instead of politics, take care of the matter. Ironically, if the court does find Meng should be extradited and she loses all appeals, the Canadian legal extradition process does become political. Canada's Attorney General, who is also Justice Minister, would then have to decide whether or not to sign the extradition papers. Craig McCulloch for VOA News, Vancouver.
A former Russian journalist currently employed by the country's space agency has been arrested and charged with state treason for passing secrets to the West. Punishment, his supporters argue, for his past coverage of sensitive Russian military and political affairs. Ivan Savronov spent much of the past decade as a military analyst and reporter and has denied the charges. He says the arrest is tied to his journalism work. U.S. President Donald Trump says he is open to another summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, even as Pyongyang signals it is uninterested in resuming stalled nuclear talks. Some analysts have questioned whether Trump has other priorities with just 4 months to go until the 2020 presidential election. However, if Trump could revive the North Korean talks, it could help highlight what White House officials had once heralded as a signature Trump foreign policy achievement. A new Human Rights Watch report says the bodies of at least 180 men found in northern Burkina Faso suggest they were extrajudicially executed by the army. The authorities have previously faced accusations of extrajudicial killings in the war against a jihadist insurgency they have been waging since 2015. The dead, who were men mostly from the Fulani and Peul ethnic groups, were buried near the northern town of Djibo between April and May. Human Rights Watch says the available evidence suggests the involvement of government security forces, and in response to the allegations, the government said it would open an inquiry. People the world over may know that African Americans and other people of color in the U.S. are more likely than whites to suffer from prejudice, poverty, and receive lower quality education and health care. Similar, but less visible, are the challenges faced by Native Americans who descended from the millions of so-called Indians who lived on this land before European colonization began in the early 1700s. Among the hardest hit Native American communities is the Navajo Nation in the American Southwest. Today, about 170,000 out of about 300,000 tribal members live on a reservation of about 70,000 square kilometers. To find out more about the Navajo, who refer to themselves as the Diné, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with attorney Ethel Branch via Zoom. She is the former attorney general for the Navajo Nation and the founder of the Navajo Hopi COVID-19 Relief Fund. She began by describing the critical lack of jobs in Navajo country.
We have really high unemployment, typically close to 50% for the United States, with 12% with the Great Recession. People were jumping off of buildings.
A lot of the work that is available for Navajo is mining, but that has caused a lot of disease on the reservation as well.
We have over 1,000 uranium sites on our nation, and we actually have the largest nuclear waste disaster site where a dam at a mill burst and spilled into one of the rivers that borders the nation. There's still the legacy of cancer arising from that. We've had spills in our northern river as well, where there's also high incidence of cancer. And then we also have the coal legacy that started in the 60s. We have one of the largest holes in the ozone layer over an area where we have three coal-fired power plants right next to each other. And then we also have the site of the dirtiest coal-fired burning plant in the country.
Why are all these uranium mines and coal plants on the reservation?
I refer to it as a national sacrifice area. We've had that status for about 100 years now. Our government was formed to facilitate quick and easy loss of our resources to the United States and American corporations. And the first official act of our council was to approve an oil and gas lease.
But the fact that corporate mining and other extractive industries are allowed to continue to devastate the land and make people so sick is seen now as an environmental justice issue.
Yeah, all of these Superfund sites are either located on or near Indian reservations or communities of color. And that's just how it is because those communities aren't viewed as having the same value as non-communities of color. And both Native Americans and African Americans have suffered from that tremendously. But we are all equal human beings, and we all have a right to have a roof over our head, food on our table, and it should be healthy food. And I think we're reaching a breaking point where people are starting to push back. And I do think that our society in general is more sympathetic and also wants to end the injustice.
COVID-19 has been a huge killer on Navajo land, where more people have died per capita than in any state. Also, per capita health funding for Native Americans is about half of what prisoners get.
Yeah, a lot of people have been watching what's happening in Indian country in the context of COVID, and they're seeing what the inequities are.
I understand there's a huge school dropout rate on Navajo land. That also goes a long way to keeping the social and economic inequities intact.
Yeah. I mean, there's a whole legacy that is behind that. When my mom was growing up, kids were being essentially kidnapped from their homes. They were placed in boarding schools far from their families. They were being forcefully assimilated, not being allowed to speak their language. Their hair was being cut. And so the association with school is not positive. But in order for things to change in Indian country, Native people and tribal leadership really has to push for that. We're segregated onto the reservations, and a lot of people don't see what's happening there. Even people in Arizona aren't aware of the vast inequities in resources in terms of lack of access to running water or electricity or broadband or whatever. But I'm hopeful that we can have a serious discussion about bringing in the critical capital infrastructure that Indian country needs just to be put on an even playing field with the rest of this country. We are always scrambling for the crumbs.
Ethel Branch is the former Attorney General for the Navajo Nation and founder of the Navajo Hopi COVID-19 Relief Fund. She was speaking to VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Releasing American citizens who have been unjustly held against their will by foreign governments is a top priority for the United States. So far, more than 40 hostages and detainees have been brought home since President Donald Trump took office. In June, Americans celebrated the release of U.S. Navy veteran Michael White from Iranian custody. Mr. White had been wrongfully detained in Iran for almost 2 years. The United States negotiated and secured his release with notable help from the Swiss government. As part of the agreement between the parties, charges were dropped on Majid Tahiri, a Florida dermatologist who had violated U.S. sanctions on Iran. At a press briefing, U.S. Special Representative for Iran, Brian Hook, said that such a successful diplomatic outcome on the consular level builds confidence that the United States and Iran are able to negotiate agreements that advance the interests of both countries. There is no question that if we could reach an agreement, a comprehensive agreement, it would advance the interests of the Iranian people. They are very tired of seeing their national wealth squandered in places like other countries in the Middle East and also in places like Venezuela. He pointed to the benefits a new deal would bring to Iran, including lifting sanctions and restoring diplomatic and economic ties. Special Representative Hook noted that Iran has so far declined the opportunity for deeper dialogue and engagement. Because of this, the United States has pursued a threefold policy toward the Iranian regime: maximum pressure, diplomatic isolation, and the credible threat of military force to defend U.S. interests. That policy, Mr. Hook declared, has denied Iran's leaders money for their malign activities. It is also the way to advance the president's goal of bringing them to the negotiating table. The president has had the door open for diplomacy for many years, said Special Representative Hook. A new and better deal will certainly benefit the people of the United States and the people of Iran.